Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
Yeah, that's kind of the message that veterans, people who serve our country in the military, that's the message they give us. Would they put their life on the line for us? The answer is yes, they do. That, of course, was Keith Urban's song for you. I thought it was a good lead into today because of the theme of today's podcast. Welcome, everybody. This is Paul Lisnick. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. We're going to have sort of a veterans services theme today with a couple of incredible guests and with magnificent work that they are doing for vets who are in need, and they are there to help. This is the kind of stuff you'd like have not heard about before, even if you know, follow veterans issues and all of that. These are really incredible and unique kind of programs. So we're going to get started. My first guest, by the way, his magic is in working with veterans to create film projects that help ease their way in terms of the difficulties they're having. You'll understand it all in a minute, but first, take a listen to a brief clip we'll use to open the interview from a video called My Moment of Truth.
Kalichi, you know, to give a testimony, first you must survive the test. I'm feeling like I'm dying from these drugs that I injected. I can go in either arm, left or right, I'm ambidextrous. My soul is desolate, my spirit is defected. I keep making wrong decisions that will never get corrected. I'm doing what I have to, never cared about the wreckage. I keep chasing this high, but I can't ever seem to catch it. I told you my story, now let me go a little deeper. I was dealing with a chemical that's deadlier than ether. I never show respect, living on the verge of death, cause this heroin will kill me, smell the murder on its breath. I'm walking on this tightrope as I'm watching every step. Now I'm living on the run, I never sleep, I never rest. I'm having trouble breathing from the pressure on my chest. This anxiety is killing me.
Yeah, that's tough stuff to listen to, especially when you understand the stories and the information behind it. Let me bring on my guest. We're going to explain it all to you. Benjamin Patton is the founder and executive director for the Patton Veterans Project, where he works with vets in VA hospitals, at vet centers, and works with them to create videos that help transition their way back into good health. Ben, welcome to you and I have met before, and I love the fact that you're joining for the podcast. Welcome for this important project in our discussion.
Well, thanks for having me, Paul. You do really wonderful service through these podcasts, particularly ones focused on veterans.
Well, thanks. And you know what? We just got to put this out up front. Your name is Benjamin Patton. We're talking about vets. Your last name is Patton. No one's going to pay any attention unless they're all sitting there going, wait a minute, Patton, Patton, like General Patton, like that guy? So fess up, what's the relationship?
Okay, so, well, the famous, let's say the more famous Patton, the one that we all saw in the movie in 1970 with George C. Scott, was my grandfather. I'm the youngest of his 10 grandchildren, I'm the youngest of five in my family. And we had enough Georges, so my father named me Ben. But my father also was a retired major general. He died in 2004, but a lovely, wonderful guy and a fantastic soldier that actually, believe it or not, was even more decorated than his father. So he's one of my heroes.
Yeah, what an incredible line that you come from. Now, you chose for your career not to be a general. You'd be a general, too, I'm sure, if you went in that direction. But instead, we can say that. Why not? But instead, you said, no, you're going to nevertheless work with vets. You're utilizing that family background, obviously everything you were exposed to bring help to veterans who are in need today. Talk about the project. Talk about how you decided to do this and got started.
Sure. Well, I mean, yes, I did choose another path, actually, but although I had thought about very seriously about the military, actually about the Navy for quite some time, and I ended up on another path, and I'm just delighted that several decades later, it's circled back. And so now what I'm doing is I'm not only doing service, but I'm also doing what I love. I'm a filmmaker and have a psychology background. And I started an organization about almost 7 years ago called the Patton Veterans Project on the idea that there are a lot of things that one can accomplish through creating narrative, particularly using the video medium, as you're very familiar with as well. And a lot of these veterans come back having experienced certain things that they come back from theater. A lot of the 2.7 million that we've sent over to Iraq and Afghanistan and other places over the last decade plus, last 15 years, and they come back having experienced things that they just can't talk about. So our hypothesis was that perhaps they couldn't talk about certain things in a normal way, but perhaps they could make a film about it. And our idea is that veterans coming together could create often fictionalized films that about sort of channeling experiences that they had, good and bad, and many of them traumatic, and that would help them express themselves in a therapeutic way, and also perhaps educate civilians like you and me about the kinds of things that they've been through.
You know, and Ben, the statistics are staggering. 20 vets a day dying by suicide. Suicide rates increasing among vets under 35. And perhaps the most disturbing, well, all that's disturbing, but over half of the vets with PTSD or depression do not even seek care. This is your way of reaching out, I imagine, both to prevent future suicides, but also to reach people who aren't seeking care in the first place.
Sure. It really is. And again, we're in the midst of a study with the VA, with support from the VA right now. But I mean, my general feeling, I think a layperson can even understand this, is that, you know, suicides don't generally happen when you're hanging out with your buddies doing something you enjoy. You know, they happen at the end of a dark hallway in the middle of the night or in situations like that. But so what we're, among other things, doing is promoting community. I mean, filmmaking is a very collaborative experience. It's very difficult, even on your shows, whether it's a podcast or a television news show or something like that. It's very difficult to undertake these kinds of initiatives by yourself. And making a film, you've got someone in front of the camera, behind the camera, someone who writes it, someone who's a narrator. You've got all these different pieces you put together, and then you assemble those pieces in a timeline, and you kind of manipulate the time-space continuum to tell a story in a very particular way, and it's highly collaborative. And therein, I think, lies its magic.
And I mentioned as I introduced you that you do these projects, you reach out to these vets at bases, VA hospitals, VA vet centers. There you are with your video cameras and your laptops ready to do your thing. What is the reaction you first get? Now, maybe now that you've worked with, you know, that you've created over 300 of these films over the last period of years, but, you know, when you first walk in, are they hesitant? Do they trust you? Does your name Patton make a difference?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a whole range because you really don't know what you're going to get. And we've been working at VA hospitals lately, and I sent you a couple of films. One we just listened to a little bit of earlier. So you really get a whole range of individuals. But by and large, a lot of them, the older veterans, have been living with their story quietly for so long, and it's very often very hard to draw it out of them. And the younger veterans, it's more of a raw nerve. But for the younger veterans, they really identify with this medium because we're sort of part of the YouTube generation now, if you will. And it's a medium that they understand very well because we all manipulate it every day on our social networking platforms. And I have a 9-year-old that knows all the codes to my phone and can make videos on his iPod Touch and so forth. But so they come in hesitant. But then once they realize that we're not trying to tell them what to do, we're just giving them suggestions based on our expertise on how to do it, on how to express something in a particular way. And then they realize that it's quite an empowering experience, that they have the tools and they have a certain sense of agency around telling, or should I say showing, the story that they're interested in showing to whomever they want to show it to. It could be just themselves, their family, or they can give us permission to put it up on YouTube.
But it's got to be so difficult for them. I'm going to actually play another clip now, another of your videos. It's called Bonds of Baggage, a film by and about veterans, but Bonds of Baggage. We're just going to play a little bit, and then you can maybe explain, because you obviously know this vet. Let's take a listen to it, and then you can tell us about it.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Doctor.
Greg. Nice to meet you, Greg.
Oh,
thanks. Please take a seat.
Hey.
So what brings you here?
I'm here because it's mandatory.
Mandatory? You're not in the military anymore.
Yeah, wife said, so it's mandatory, you know what I'm saying?
I understand. I'm married, too. I can relate.
Yeah, it's about the only thing you relate to, but all right. here's the thing. So, don't worry about it. So, how does this go? What do you want me to do?
So, what brings you here? I know the wife, but...
So, and I cut it there because then some interesting things happen in the film where basically the vet starts to talk about, I'm here for things that have happened that are real, and then you really have to see the film. The audio doesn't do it justice. But talk to me about Greg. I don't know if that's his real name. He goes in to see a doctor. I don't know if it's a real doctor. Maybe these are all actors. Maybe it's scripted. Talk about what we just heard.
Well, in this film, I forget whether they had names per se in this second film. But in the film you just showed, it basically sets up a situation, which often happens, where a veteran comes into to a hospital or a clinic, and they're just expecting some civilian person in a white coat to not really understand what they've been through and not be able to relate. And so they're just kind of there on autopilot, you know, just checking the box. At least that's how the veteran often perceives it. In this particular situation, an African-American NCO walks into some sort of possibly a mandatory clinical session, and he immediately draws the conclusion this guy doesn't get it. And, white guy with a beard and a white coat. And what happens is we begin to see that the person who is ostensibly the clinician starts to have his own PTSD episode as he's hearing the other person's story. So just after the point where you cut it, we begin to hear the one person's voice, the client or the patient's voice, get kind of morphed, and so it doesn't really, you don't really hear the words anymore, and we sort of drift into this other person's head, and the patient begins to think that guy's checked out. But before he gets up and leaves, the clinician stops him and says, "Hey, hold on a second. I served too, and I actually think we have more in common than you realize. I've been through some of this stuff too." And then they bond. And again, it's somewhat stereotypical, I guess you would say, but it does show you that a lot of these things are a matter of perspective. If you can put yourself in the other person's shoes, and even as a veteran, and realize that a clinician may or may not have been through a similar experience to you and maybe can relate to you, then it can be quite therapeutic. And similarly, with my film instructors, I'd say maybe 75% of them are civilians, and these veterans will come in, and they might, as you said, cozy up to us because of my last name or because they're interested in learning about film. But more often than not, they're going to look at us as civilians and say, "Okay, here we go. Let's see what I can get out of it." But then they're surprised to find that, in fact, some of the filmmakers are veterans, and other filmmakers who aren't veterans have a touch and have a sensitivity and also know how to help that veteran articulate something and express it, often without any words at all. And it's quite a powerful moment of community around this particular medium. And then they begin to then allow us in once they see that we're there not to tell them what to do, but simply to tease out their story on their terms.
Ben, do they understand that this is a form of therapy? Do you tell them that when you meet them? Or is this one of those things that kind of unfolds? They have the experience once they begin to trust you, and then there's sort of an awakening.
It's a little bit of both, but in some cases where we're doing this as part of an overt study, a clinical study in connection with a VA hospital, we certainly do tell them, and they have to fill out certain surveys ahead of time. In general, I tell them that, but I don't emphasize that because I want them to come in with a sort of a blank canvas so that they can draw on that whatever they want, but they very quickly see through it that it has a therapeutic element as they start to connect with people that they wouldn't have spoken to the day before and say things and do things that they wouldn't have done a few days before. I mean, it becomes pretty obvious that it's therapeutic. And the trick, I think, for these things and what I'm really striving for as an organization is hopefully some your listeners and others will hear this. Hear about this program and realize that it's an important step and possibly an incredibly valuable or even invaluable gateway step, but it isn't the last step. It's really an early step. And I think the trick is follow-up. How do you get that veteran to the next step, that one that opens up and starts sharing something with you? What do you do next to get them where they need to go? And I think that's the great challenge here.
The couple of clips I played were playable because they were sort of – they had an audio component to it that works effectively, so that worked. I, of course, have seen many of your films. People can go to your website, which is pattonveteransproject.org, and see a variety of films. Fair enough, that is where they would see these?
Yeah, and I think actually the best place to see them is up on our YouTube site now, which is starting to get some traction, and that's just the I Was There Film Workshop's YouTube channel, and they can see a number of things. But yes, it's a great way to get a sense of these of what's going on. And you're right, a lot of, in fact, the vast majority of the films have no speaking in them at all. But as you know, although you are a host of a number of shows and what's and so forth, this medium actually lends itself to the visual component and to it's a multi-sensory, you know, experience video, but so is post-traumatic stress. You know, you experience it through your eyes, through your ears, through your sense of smell and taste and whatnot and touch. And so it's a very tactile thing. And I think that's why this medium works so well, because it can hit you from all sides, and we can really get very close to their experiences through this medium.
One of the videos that I've seen, and you and I have talked about, so I just wanted you to describe it for my listeners. It was somebody who found it difficult, as I recall, to kind of tell their story by performing. They used dolls, G.I. Joes. Talk about that.
Right. Well, I'll never forget that, because I was at Fort Campbell with these two wonderful guys, Jason Tatro and James Dean. Both retired sergeants, and they're just lovely guys. But they came in that day to Fort Campbell, and their CO had probably said, all right, I want to fill this room. You know, it's kind of voluntold some of these guys to be there. And these two gentlemen sat in the back. They were being med boarded, is the term, sort of medically retired in the coming months, and with various issues, whether they were physical injuries and mental injuries and other things. And they were just not very happy with where they were. And in fact, that the Army, it felt some level of disloyalty, I think they felt, to the Army, requiring them to be medically retired. And so they sat in the back, very near the door, you know, a little jumpy and not happy to be there. And then when they realized through an initial exercise we did with the group, an abstract exercise and some of our lectures, they began to realize that this, in fact, was an opportunity and not a requirement. In fact, they were free to leave whenever they wanted. So what happened was 3 days later, they had made a film using almost entirely still photographs of G.I. Joes in varying positions, you know, sitting in front of an I Want You sign, and then again and again and again, and in front of their unit insignia, and then later on hanging on the hospital road sign, and then finally ending up in the garbage surrounded by pill bottles and beer bottles, which relative to the size of the G.I. Joe were pretty large. And so that sort of those various metaphors told us a story about this individual, this generic G.I. Joe character, and what he'd experienced. And I think the final scene was the only video of it was a woman walking up to the garbage can and picking up the G.I. Joe. It's called Broken, and it's actually up on our YouTube channel. But it was very powerful because they realized that they got to choose exactly how much of themselves they put into a film and what that part of them was, which part of them. And in this case, they put their story in, but they didn't necessarily have to reveal a single specific fact about themselves. And I think they both had a quite cathartic experience as a result. And one of them, who initially wouldn't even tell me his name, went on an NPR show with me a month later. And we had an incredibly powerful experience together. And I'm still friends with both of them.
Can you talk about the collaboration process? So when you're going to make a film, that one or anyone, how much of it, because look, these guys are not filmmakers, right? So do they really depend on you? Do you say, let's talk about this, I'll help you find the way to present your story? Or do you find that more often than not, once they get it, they determine how the story needs to be told?
Right. Once they get it, they determine it, to be honest. And let's say we're not filmmakers necessarily, and you may not be either per se, although you're a producer of this show and other shows, but we're all film watchers and we're all film critics and we all have ideas about what we like and don't like. And so as soon as you're shown the tools to manipulate that medium and really helps to understand how simple it is in many ways to tell a story through just pictures or videos, then it becomes quite empowering. So initially, yes, they come in and they look to us for the expertise, but you know, my 9-year-old already knows how to edit, and Apple and other computer companies and software companies make programs that can be manipulated very, very easily by young people. And we can all edit with simply free downloaded software. We can all edit on our smartphones. So it's probably one of the most accessible ways to create narrative that there is. And so once they get a hold of it and they grab onto it, I think the most amazing thing is they tend to forget themselves. they tend to lose themselves in the creative process. And then when they get to the end of it, they have this sudden realization that, wow, I actually got to make a story that's largely what I want to say. And I just want to add one other thing to it, and that is that because it's collaborative, the collaboration in this way has this added benefit of providing you the filter of metaphor between you and your actual history. So if you and I collaborated on a film, let's say on loss or transition or something like that, then if we broaden out the story enough so that it's not specific to one of us, but we have to give up a little bit of our specific story to make it relevant to the other person, then in fact, it's probably relevant to a lot of people.
You've worked with over 1,000 vets. Again, I said 300 films in the past, 7 years or so. What I noticed was you've done this work on like 8 different bases around, but you also did it in Israel. How did that connection happen?
So fascinating. Israel was absolutely fascinating. They have a very different makeup of soldiers there. First of all, just about everybody serves in the military. Most people, they all do national service, and most of them serve in the military. And they have different advantages and disadvantages and qualities to their deployments. They're much shorter deployments. They go home every couple of weeks, but they're more frequent and they're more recent. And so what we found is a very interesting dynamic. We've done 2 workshops in Israel, but we've also done workshops with U.S. and Israeli veterans working together. And in one case, they didn't even speak the same language at all. These were highly traumatized combat veterans from Israel with combat veterans from the U.S. And they literally could only speak through a translator. And yet, in many cases, the pairs of these veterans collaborated together on powerful, powerful films. There's one called In the Ocean that's about 2 soldiers, one's an Israeli and one's an American. They're wandering through the streets of New York, and suddenly they see each other. And when they clasp hands, they find themselves sort of in a wide open field, just connecting in ways that you could never really describe. So it's quite something. And one interesting thing about the Israelis, too, is that I had an experience where the younger veterans tended to be the ones that were actually more reluctant to speak about things because the trauma was so recent. And the older veterans working with the younger veterans showed this kind of generational gap closing between the two of them, where the younger veterans actually needed the older veterans to coax them out of their shells. And it was quite beautiful. So I've had a lot of great experiences with them. And in the end, a soldier is a soldier. And they all identify with many of the same metaphors. And it's quite something. This particular film is one of my favorites.
You know, I'm curious to hear your grandfather, who was in the heat of battle. I think I'd mentioned to you my uncle served under him in the Battle of the Bulge. What an incredible career, your father as well. Because this project started after they were both gone, what would they say if they knew you were doing this work, having come from their backgrounds of literally seeing the battles?
Well, that's going to be certainly a subjective answer, but I would say that, I would like to think they would both be very supportive of it. First of all, they were both filmmakers. My father spent our whole childhood with a Super 8 movie camera and a big rack. Looked like a rack of a 12-point deer with all these lights on it, at Christmas. And we'd all have to wait before we came downstairs. And every time there would be an interesting historical event or a battlefield. We went to a lot of battlefields in my family on vacation. He would bring the movie camera. And likewise, his father was filming everything, I think, because they understood on a number of levels. They understood the value of history, so they wanted to record it. But I also think that if they reflected on the reasoning behind it and the way we do this, I think they would appreciate it. They both wrote extensively, my grandfather had thousands of pages of diaries, as did my father. And they really understood the importance of preserving history. And now knowing that beyond just editing together, splicing together Super 8 tape, they could take a modern editing program and put together a lot of different kinds of material to be able to recall it and sort of re-render it in a new way. I think they would have appreciated it. And I also would say that they both, while they were known for their vigor and audacity on the battlefield, I think both my father and my grandfather were recognized for that. They were also recognized for taking care of their troops. And while they've had incidents, both of them, that have involved, tough incidents dealing with soldiers, I think deep down they cared deeply about their men. And if they saw a tool that was potentially helpful to the men and women in uniform that serve our country, I think they would have jumped at it.
So here's a story that I think is related, but you might call it off base. But you told it to me once, and I would just love to share it with my listeners. And it was when they were making the movie Patton about your grandfather. My memory was that you guys weren't very involved in it, a concern about how they might portray him and what was going to be. And then, of course, George C. Scott, who was one of the great actors of all time. Can you just, do you mind telling the story of the time that he came to your home?
Well, I mean, there's funny parts to it and profound parts to it. I mean, I'll tell you it in two parts. The first thing is when the film was seen, I was probably too young because I was about 5 years old. But I remember the first part of it is when my brother and my older brothers and sisters went with my parents to probably one of the major theaters in New York City, like the Paris or something, and snuck in the back and watched the film. And I remember my brother writes about hearing my father just have one sort of brief sniffle when he got to a certain part of the film that, you know, my father was trying to not show his emotion, but he just couldn't help it. Because I think deep down, my father was also a fan of his father. I mean, it was hard not to be.
Sure.
And as far as the George C. Scott story, I think I was there, but I probably as much remembering it retold to me as I remember the actual story. But George C. Scott, you got to love him. He was a bit of a lush, and he came over and he had been very nervous because he wanted to make sure he portrayed the character in an accurate way. And he didn't look anything like my grandfather, and he didn't sound anything like my grandfather. But he exuded him, I think. And my aunts and uncles and dad have always said that. But anyway, he came over to our house. He brought a copy of the film on 16 millimeter. Very tall guy. Came in and he asked my father for a drink. And I said, what would you like? And he said, I'll have a Bloody Mary. And my dad went over to the bar. We had a bar in the corner of the living room, which my mother always said she hated. She said she was one thing she changed after he passed was she got rid of the bar in the living room. Because she never liked having it out in the open. But anyway, so my dad goes over and makes him a Bloody Mary, Mr. and Mrs. T, and a little Worcestershire sauce, and some vodka and some ice, and puts it in there. And George C. Scott purportedly takes a sip and spits it out and says, what the hell is this? And he says, and my dad says, what's a Bloody Mary? He says, where's your bar? So he goes over and he grabs a highball glass, and he says, Joan Patton, he says, can you give me a quarter? And my dad hands him a quarter. And he drops it in the bottom of the glass, and he pours just enough tomato juice to cover the quarter, and then he fills it with vodka and ice and drinks it, and it looks like pink lemonade. And he said, "Boy, that's a damn good. That's a damn good Bloody Mary." So, no, you know, it was pretty funny to have been near that story. But he really did care a lot about the character, and he really didn't care about the awards or anything. In fact, he didn't even accept his award for the Oscar, which was one of eight that it won.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's been a great ride to the family, but I must tell you that my hero in the family is my father, and I wrote a book about him about 6 years ago called Growing Up Patton, and wasn't a bestseller, but I wouldn't change a word of it because he was a wonderful soldier and a wonderful father.
Well, I'm going to get that book, actually. I look forward to reading that. Because obviously,
well, I'll send you a copy.
Well, I'll send you my new book, Assume Guilt. See that? We just plugged both.
Super. But anyway, it really was something, and you got to, you know, I don't know if we have time for this, but my father, you have to keep in mind, he grew up in the ashes of World War II, and, you know, just on the heels of it, and he graduated from West Point 6 months after his father died as a result of a freak car accident, and when someone came up to him at graduation in 1946, now that he was well known as the next George Patton, and he was just going into, you know, it was the first day of his military career at graduation, someone came up to him who had served under my grandfather and said, "You'll never be the man your father was, but congratulations anyway."
Wow.
And I always thought that the fact that my father went from there to earn two stars and two distinct, you know, the two each of the second and third highest medals for valor you can get along with the Purple Heart, I think says a lot about what kind of a guy he was.
So
I think he'd be pretty happy with what I'm doing. And I have conversations with him every night.
You're indeed a proud son and a proud grandson. I want to encourage everybody to check out the videos. Go to YouTube and type in "I was there" film workshops. Watch some of these incredible videos, and then also go to the website where I assume folks can donate to you or help fund this project. Right?
They certainly can. It's a nonprofit organization. It's really a bootstrap operation, but we're just limited by funding and opportunity right now. But I really do think that, as you said at the beginning, with some of those statistics of the vets that are really stigmatized by walking into a VA hospital, which is why we don't work at the hospital that often, and going even into a classroom on a base, they just want to do these things on their own terms, and they're not necessarily ready to talk to a professional clinician yet. Often that can help, and I think the VA gets a bad gets a bad rap because so much of what they do is great. And but anyway, so as an early step, we believe that what we're doing can be valuable. And if over time, when we get the results of our study and so forth that come out, I think we'll be able to show that this intervention is a wonderful gateway for those veterans who are most resistant to care. And it's also a valuable educational tool for you and I.
The website is PattonVeteransProject.org. Benjamin Patton, the founder and executive director of the Patton Veterans Project. I will thank you for the service that your family has given to this country through the many decades that they have served, but also to you because, you know, you don't have to be in the theater of war as your grandfather was your father to make a difference in the world of those who serve our country. You are making that difference. And I thank you for your time now. I wish you continued luck and best wishes for the project that you're doing. And in the end, I am sure a lot will be learned about it. Many veterans' lives will be saved. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, and I would just like to say thank you, Paul, because really, and I really mean this from the bottom of my heart, our interactions so far, different places, and the ways that you've helped us get the word out and other people that are doing service for this country is itself a very, very valuable service. And you'll find us on Facebook and Instagram, Patton Veterans Project, and Twitter even. But I just wanted to say thank you to you and your team for just making this an important part of what you do. And we civilians and veterans that I work with alike, thank you for that.
My job is to bring the important projects and people to my listeners and viewers. That is you. Thank you, Ben Patton. Appreciate your time.
God bless.
A homeless man died last night, a Korean War veteran who was wearing a coat I gave to the Goodwill. It had my card in it.
Toby, you're not responsible.
An hour and 20 minutes for the ambulance to get there. A Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, 2nd of the 7th. I got better treatment in Panmunjom.
Toby, if we start pulling strings like this, you don't think every homeless veteran will come out of the woodwork?
I can only hope, sir.
Well, that, of course, a clip from The West Wing, one of my all-time favorite shows, but it's really not about The West Wing. It's about the topic that they are talking about, and that is the notion of a homeless veteran. You know, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, estimates that 40,056 vets are homeless on any given night, not getting the medical, the mental health services that they may need. Well, there is one gentleman who's doing something about it. His name is Stephen Peck. He's the president and CEO of U.S. Vets. We met in Washington, D.C., where we were taping a show called Newsmakers, and I invited you to do the podcast, Steve. Thanks for joining me. Your mission is to get vets in need the help they deserve. Fair enough?
It is, absolutely.
So talk about what you do. I know homelessness is only part of the problem, but how is it? Why is it in this society when we're supposed to care for our vets more so than most other people, we just don't do a good job?
That is a great question. I first began doing this 25 years or so ago. And when I would see any homeless person on the street, it would make me feel angry, actually, that they were reduced to the point where no one would take care of them. They didn't have a roof over their head. And then at that point, 25 years ago, I learned that 30% of all homeless men were veterans. And those were my comrades from Vietnam. And I actually met a couple of guys that I've known over the years that served in the same unit that I did. And I understood that the VA simply did not have the capacity to deal with this. And aside from that, it's really a societal problem. It's not just a VA problem. It's a community problem. Our communities are too expensive. There are not enough services. So it is up to agencies like U.S. Vets to augment what the VA is doing, act as a center post for the community and gather all the resources we can to help get them off the street.
You indeed did serve. You mentioned this, but I should have done it as part of your introduction. You were a Marine officer in Vietnam. So you're coming home to make a difference. And actually, annually, you guys assist 4,000 vets in finding housing, in getting jobs. Can you talk a little bit about, from your experience, which kind of comes first? Is it a PTSD thing that leads to homelessness? Are they homeless because they're losing their jobs? How does the scenario develop, and then how do you bring them out of it all?
I think that's the challenge of addressing this situation. People want to say it's one thing or the other. It's just the housing. It's just substance abuse. It's just post-traumatic stress. And really, it is a combination of any number of those things. So when USSTETS first started back in 93, we determined that we would have to bring all those services under a single roof, not only get them off the street and into safe and supportive housing, but provide the employment assistance, provide the substance abuse treatment and the mental health treatment that will really get them back on their feet and enable them to move forward.
Some people listening might say, isn't that what the VA does? Isn't that their job? So how are they doing it?
They are not doing it, and pretty much they have said it is not their job. They have, over the years, become a medical center. Our VA here in Los Angeles is very much a medical center, and they view this as a societal problem like we did. They do not provide the housing and the wraparound support services that we are able to do. So we access VA funding. They have specific funding to for agencies like ours to contract and provide housing and services for veterans. But really, we provide a much more holistic solution, if you want. It's not just a medical solution. It's not just the employment or the mental health. It's all of those things put together, which is critical if we are to get homeless veterans off the street. That's changing a little bit here in Los Angeles. USSTETS has just been made. We're part of the team that's going to now build 900 units of housing at the West Los Angeles VA. That is a major milestone that's been many years coming, but it's going to begin to then turn the VA back into a more holistic provider of services for homeless veterans.
Do you find, Steve, being a veteran yourself, that veterans helping and working with vets is more effective than non-veterans working with vets? How important is it that a vet helping a vet is part of the process?
I don't think it's critical. I think there are a lot of good social workers out there and case managers who really want to help veterans and other people with their issues. In our agency, we're about 40% veterans on our staff. We have a staff of 450 at all of our 11 sites across the country. We have a rule that our board of directors must be at least 51% veterans, just to maintain that veterans perspective, that cultural competency. And I personally think our leadership needs to be made up of veterans. So so people know that we really do understand what it is they're going through. When I was an outreach worker many years ago, I would keep a picture of myself in uniform behind my desk so that they could immediately see that they're talking to another vet, and that really got them pathway there so that I could gain their trust.
The need for mental health, when you greet these vets, when you see these vets, are you finding them and bringing them in and getting them these services, or are you perhaps finding them in other kind of treatment facilities? How are they making their way to you?
In a variety of ways. We have an outreach team at each one of our locations that goes out into the community, visits the place where homeless people congregate, goes to the VA, goes to the soup kitchens, I mean, anywhere a homeless person might go to for services, we'll visit there. And then when we bring them in, they'll access not only services from our social workers and psychologists, but we'll also refer them to the VA, because in some cases the VA is very good at what they do. They simply don't have the capacity, but we'll use literally every resource that we can find to get them the services that they need.
Talk about the money piece of this in terms of the funding that you get, because, I mean, as a veteran, they are entitled to compensation, pension benefits. Are some of them not even collecting it? How does the money picture look in all of this and helping you fund what you do?
They do have benefits available to them. It is not always enough money to support them. And really, if we want to get them completely well, we want them to support themselves. We don't encourage them to go seeking that kind of compensation unless they really are disabled to the extent that they cannot work. Work can be a very, very powerful tool to get to bring someone back to a place of real self-esteem and pride and accomplishment, and we want them to do that if they are able. But if not, we will help them get their disability benefits so that they, at the very least, have a roof over their head, are not homeless, and are accessing VA services that are available to them.
Can you talk a bit about the success rate? So, I mean, for the years you've been doing this, obviously you've helped so many. Any stories come to your mind where you say, wow, this it was all worth it because of this guy?
We have any number of success stories.
I'm sure you've got many of them, yeah.
Numbers. One of our executive directors in Los Angeles was a homeless veteran. We found him in jail. One guy I've been working with lately, I've happened to meet him. He went through our Long Beach site, had been homeless for 10 years. And he was in the Navy, experienced, was in a place where there was an explosion and the two guys next to him were killed. And so he really had a lot of psychological issues and had a very, very hard time reintegrating, was using drugs and alcohol. Just it was a mess and was in a place where he couldn't trust anybody. So our outreach worker met him a few years ago in a park in Long Beach and visited him every week or two for a year. It took a year for our outreach worker to gain this guy's trust, talking to him, saying all the things that we could help him with. We could put a roof over his head. He finally came in and immediately was embraced by the community that we have down in Long Beach and by his case manager. And they began to tell him things that he never imagined. He had a disability payment available to him. He had an education benefit. This is a guy who had 2 years of college. He came all the way back, was with us for 2 years, now has his own apartment, and is in his final year of social work school at Long Beach University. So it's a complete turnaround, and if you saw him now, you just couldn't believe that he had been on the street literally for 10 years.
Incredible story. And, you know, your life could have taken a different path. You've gone this path, which is so critical, and the vets need you so much. But I don't mean to take you off guard with it a little bit, but this is too much fun for me not to do this. Your name, of course, is Stephen Peck. And when I first came across your name, I kind of wondered, that is really an interesting last name to me. And so maybe our listeners aren't connecting it yet, but they're about to as I play this clip.
Okay.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Steve, did that voice sound familiar to you?
Oh, it does. That speech still gives me chills after all this time. It never gets old.
That, of course, is from To Kill a Mockingbird. Your father was Gregory Peck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and yeah, so yeah. Now he, of
and
course,
that was such that movie, that story, that book has become such a part of our lives. And really, the character that he played in that, Atticus Finch, really is our North Star. I mean, he was a better father than anyone has ever seen. He was certainly an idealistic version of what a father could be. And Dad was so thrilled and so grateful to have been able to do that. It certainly used his very, very best instincts. Those were ideas that he believed deeply. And it just reminds us every time we see it what we can aspire to.
And indeed, of course, your path could have gone that way. It did for a while, right? You went into the world of documentary filmmaking, so you did have a film-related career. And let's give your son a plug. Your son has gone into his grandfather's direction of performing.
He has. My wife and I just got back from Toronto last night, where he is filming in the second season of Star Trek Discovery. He is the new Mr. Spock. So,
how cool is that? How proud are you?
I am now introduced as the father of Spock. How great is that?
That's pretty great. But I think he is likely very proud of the work that his dad did. And you should all be proud of the work that your father and his grandfather did. And he did some war movies and all of that. So he was, you know, your father clearly one of the finest actors ever to grace the silver screen, as far as I'm concerned, in this country. You probably will not disagree with me.
I will not. He had an extraordinary career, and a career, the kind of career that you don't see much anymore. So I'm really proud of him.
I want to thank you for the work that you do. People can check you out at usvetsinc.org, usvets, V-E-T-S, inc.org. You need support, right? You're not-for-profit. People ought to help you. They ought to learn about you. And if they can help support the work you do to help the people who have served this country, I imagine that's something that you'd appreciate as well.
Absolutely. This only happens with the support of people in communities all over the country, so we need all the support that we can get.
Stephen Peck, the president and CEO of U.S. Vets, thank you, sir, for the work that you do. Thank you as well for the joy that your son and your father have given the world through their work. But thank you most importantly for the work you're doing to make this world a better place. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
All right.